So I'll start by introducing our speaker, Clive Leventhal. Clive is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia, the Actuarial Society of South Africa, and also the Institute of Actuaries in the UK. Clive also holds the Chartered Financial Analyst CFA designation and has attended the Wharton Business School in Philadelphia. He's currently CEO of Experian Insurance, which is a national firm of life insurance advisors. And prior to this, he was head of life insurance, wealth products, and underwriting at Clearview for 2.5 years. Clive was also general manager, product manager at CommInsure, where he had responsibility for products covering life insurance, general insurance, and a wide range of superannuation and investment products over 11 years. Clive has had various senior management positions at CommInsure and internationally for nearly 20 years.
Right, good afternoon, everyone. For those of you just coming in, I recommend seats at the front will be good. The font size is a little bit small, so you've got a natural advantage if you come up closer. You've all just had lunch, so you're probably feeling a little bit tired, so I'm going to put in some extra effort just to liven it up and hopefully make it as exciting as possible. Just before I start, this presentation is really an amalgamation of a number of public sources of information, and hopefully what I've done today is just package it up and present it in a way that you find interesting, and particularly trying to draw on my observations in the work that I've done in my previous role working for a manufacturer and my new role on the other side of the fence actually selling largely life insurance products. So I'll just begin with a high-level overview on the life insurance industry. The industry now amounts to about $11 billion in in-force annual premiums, still quite a lot smaller than the PHI market, also quite a lot smaller than the general insurance market, but a lot bigger than it used to be when I first joined the industry. The in-force premiums grown from about $4 billion in, say, 2003 to now $11 billion today, so well over double-digit compound growth, which is great. Even though there are free kicks in some of the segments like with age re-rating and CPI re-rating, taking into account lapse rates, it's still a very good result, driven largely by increased awareness in under insurance levels. And I'd say probably the main reason is because of the ever-increasing amount in superannuation, which is now funding a lot of the life insurance premiums. The retail segment makes up about two-thirds of the market. Group makes up about a third. The segment I play in today, which is independent financial advisors, makes up again about two-thirds of the retail market, and direct makes up about 10%. But that's on an in-force basis. On a new business basis, it's quite different. Direct's a lot higher, and banks are slowly, whether purposefully or non-purposefully, selling more through their own in-house bank planners rather than necessarily IFAs. There's 11 what I call active insurers competing across four dominant channels, being IFAs, bank distribution with their in-house planners who only sell the bank's products generally, group insurance, and more recently there's kind of an explosion in the direct segment. And with bank distribution, there's also what I would call consumer credit insurance in that channel. In my opinion, there's really only four major reinsurers participating actively to support the front insurers, although there are two smaller insurers also involved, so six all up. One reinsurer is participating directly to some extent in the group market and the direct market, and another reinsurer, larger reinsurers, participating directly in some direct segments. Interestingly, though, despite the high growth in the in-force premiums, the profits are not strong, and the required returns on capital are not really being achieved by many insurers. Now, the reasons for that are many. I've noticed with some dismay that a number of public announcements lately from the major insurers are blaming lapse rates and claims rates for the problems. And many of them like to blame people like myself and our business, which is selling products in the independent segment. And I completely disagree with a lot of those comments. I think a lot of the lapses, so-called lapses, are lapses being experienced by those companies whose competitiveness have fallen dramatically over the years. And what you'll see is companies that have launched newer products like BT, Clearview, and a few others, their lapse rates are actually quite low. And certainly the lapse rates of business sold through independent financial advisors are much lower than the lapse rate you see in direct business, and sometimes even through bank-based selling, and certainly a lot lower than consumer credit insurance. So I'd just like to try to dispel that myth to some extent. And then in terms of high claims rates, I think manufacturers, again, have a lot to be responsible for. I've seen very little investments in the Australian market from manufacturers in terms of claims management systems, claims technology, and so on. So I think the blame for a number of the problems should surely be looked at by the manufacturers themselves. In particular, we see retail IP and group insurance profits are very weak. And there's also a large, there has been a large legacy portfolio, both life insurance and superannuation investments portfolios at the larger insurers. And those products, the legacy products, were written on very high profit margins in the 80s and 90s and sometimes even before that. And the profit margins on that older business is almost double, sometimes more than double, than the profit margins that we see on the newer business. So what you're seeing is as those older books are running off, the newer business isn't replacing those profit streams at the same equivalent margin. So there's a lot of pressure in manufacturers to keep their profits even steady, let alone to grow them. So this high growth in premiums and the low profitability I've written here will clash soon. It's already clashing. We're starting to see some of our clients facing 58% price rises on their renewals. We're seeing massive price rises in the group market. The direct market, I think, hasn't seen any price rises, and that's because the prices are already quite expensive in that segment and competition hasn't been strong, at least in the eyes of the or when you're thinking about from a consumer point of view. In our market, we find, just the same as in almost all markets around the world, that consumers are largely apathetic when it comes to buying life insurance. Unlike other products, consumers do not seek out the cover. You need good salespeople, advisors, aggressive telemarketers, group insurance where cover is given to you and you don't even know you've got it, or it's given on a compulsory basis, or even when it comes to consumer credit insurance, opt-out type covers. To make people have the cover that they have today, which is a challenge, and unfortunately, especially when you think of our products facing taxes like stamp duty and very little other incentives like we've had in private health insurance or some other products in the market. What's interesting is the products that are sold are very channel-specific. You'll see, for example, trauma insurance is mainly sold by advisors and not necessarily through direct products. The only real product that is consistently sold across all channels is death cover and to some extent accidental death cover. And certainly what I've seen is that in the direct market, there is very little price competitiveness or product competitiveness. The success of direct insurance really stems down to the distribution strategy and those that have executed their distribution strategy well, which has largely been TV advertising, have been the winners in that space. We're also seeing that the internet still remains largely a channel, largely a mechanism for consumers to do research, and I certainly haven't seen big uptakes in internet sales from a direct point of view. And even for the many people in the advice industry that encourage people to go into sites to use their brokerage services, it's very hard to make a buck with those channels because you get a lot of tire kickers and people shopping around. And the cost of doing any business on the internet, especially with the cost of keyword searching for life insurance being so expensive, is hard to generate a good return. In terms of the retail advice channel, which is where my business focuses, I'd say that the channel is pretty efficient. Certainly when it comes to things like commission rates and product features, there's a lot of consistency around the market. The other myth I think I'd like to focus on a bit is there's a lot of talk in virtually every seminar conference I go to about insurers chasing research house ratings and advisors moving people because definitions are slightly better than the next. That is really not the case. And I think in most academic discussions, I see trauma insurance making up far bigger share of the conversation than it does happen in reality. A lot of the inefficiency, in my opinion, comes down to premium rates. And if you have ever looked at the ranges of premium rates across the thousands and thousands of pricing combinations out there, depending on age, gender, occupation, and so on, the range of rates is absolutely massive, and that's where most of the activity happens, is because the rates can be up to 40% different in many, many cases, and that's where I see the inefficiencies in the market taking place. In terms of the advice segment, what I've seen makes a big difference is also like direct control of distribution. Banks and so on who own their own planning channels do get a lot of sales from those channels. They are able to capture that. Relationship management is a skill that many insurers are losing quite rapidly over time. A lot of people want to deal with insurers with stable management, stable people that they know will be there in 10 years' time when a claim from a policy they're selling today is there. And we're not seeing that in a number of manufacturers, which does cause a lot of concern in certainly the advice segment. And the underwriting service levels is also absolutely paramount, far more important than product features and sometimes even more important than the price, because if you're an advisor and you're spending hours and hours and hours trying to get somebody to agree to buy insurance and then actually go through the process, making sure that that person gets through underwriting is paramount, because otherwise you don't get paid. And you can spend 10 hours or more on many prospects and not get paid because the case doesn't go through underwriting. In terms of technology, the industry, again, has very much been in the dark ages. Only recently have we seen some good technological developments, front-end quote tools, the ability to track applications in suspense. But in many other respects, the industry still remains in the dark ages compared to, say, the airlines or other companies that I deal with on a day-to-day basis as a consumer. You can't go online, change your address with most insurance companies. You can't go online and change your credit card details because your date on your credit card is expiring. So we really hope that insurers spend a lot more money on their technology for consumers, but also in terms of their technology for very important processes like claims management. And what I'm seeing is banks are a major player in the advice segment, but I'm seeing that banks who are not competitive are slowly, whether it's conscious or not consciously, moving away from the IFA segment because they're unable to compete and focusing on the segment which is a lot lazier, which is in-house bank planners. And then in terms of superannuation, that's the big story in the industry. There's now over $1.4 trillion in superannuation. Add to that the $600 billion that is in household deposits, and together there you've got a $2 trillion base to fund the premiums in the insurance segment. So $2 trillion could fund the life insurance sector for over 100 years just today. Life insurance premiums paid by superannuation assets take up about 0.5% of superannuation assets per annum. So superannuation is the place to be in terms of having insurance premiums funded. And I think it's a great tool for many consumers because it helps with virtually the number one issue, which is affordability. And if consumers are able to use otherwise preserved money to fund what isn't a very important current need, then that's a fantastic outcome, and I hope that remains for as long as possible. Just briefly, and I've taken a chart here from Rice Warner on superannuation. A very large segment in my opinion, I think the fourth largest in the world. Still got a lot of growth to go. There's predictions that we'll hit $3 trillion by 2027. The key takeout for me in the section on superannuation that I've focused on in this presentation is firstly the slow demise, or maybe fast demise, of corporate super or employer-based super plans. Those were big sectors in the past, but what we're seeing is certainly with employer-based super plans, because of FOFA, there isn't an appropriate mechanism for financial advisors to charge the members of those plans or the employers to run employer-based schemes, because there's things like opt-in to the annual fees every 2 years, which is very difficult to operate effectively when you're dealing with a firm of, say, 200 or 300 employees. And we're also seeing that with the large corporate super plans at big companies, those are slowly, I think, also going to phase out because they can't meet certain of the future regulatory requirements, like requiring them to give open access to be an appropriate My Super product. So I certainly see and agree with some comments that I've seen in various Rice Warner publications that the industry is certainly moving towards personal super and away from collective super, which is how I would describe it. And the other trend I'm seeing, which is quite interesting, is the whole aged care segment and the whole aged care sector. And I'll come to that and expand on that shortly. In terms of, well, I'll probably just touch on that now. In terms of the post-retirement sector, what we're seeing is that the age pension was a very big item for most pensioners in the past and still is reasonably large in the eyes of many pensioners. But the age pension now is only making up about 40% of the average Australian wage. And with so much money emerging out of superannuation, I think the age pension will become less and less relevant in a lot of strategies for pensioners when they retire. And we're already seeing that in Australia, the amount of money coming out from pensions as pension payments or income streams from post-retirement assets is already as large as the amount the government is spending on the age pension. So there's going to be a big and continuing stream of money flowing out in income streams going forward. I know there's a lot of talk about forcing the government to follow practices in other countries and not having the ability to take out as much in lump sums. But I think, and whilst I agree with that, I think there naturally just is a lot of money coming out in income streams anyway. And in terms of aged care with the ageing population, there's going to be an ever-increasing need for aged care services. But most people, I think, naturally think that all of aged care services are provided in residential homes. But that's not necessarily the case. Most people are trying to stay in their homes for as long as possible, and the government is also changing all of its schemes and incentives to try and encourage home care for as long as possible at the expense of far more expensive residential care, and within residential care, again, far more expensive acute care. So we're seeing far more people getting at-home packages than there are people in residential care or nursing care. And I think that trend certainly will continue. And what I think the stats show later on in the presentation is people are trying to stay at home almost until about the last year and a half, until they get so sick that they do need to go to acute care. And I think it's about 70% of people that go to aged care go to the acute care rather than the, say, non-acute care. And I think products from the insurance industry are likely to emerge to help funding for that last year and a half of life where it's very expensive and the need is very high. Okay, so just covering a few stats and pieces of information about the life risk market. Again, there's 11 dominant insurers. About half of them are bank-owned. Retail makes up about two-thirds. Group makes up about one-third. Four what I regard as dominant insurers, two smaller insurers, a number of inactive insurers, also, and one insurer that doesn't really play in the life risk space, and 13 friendly societies who are capable of transacting some business, but I'm not sure exactly what their long-term purpose is going to be. Underinsurance has been a big topic. The industry has done very well in promoting the concept of underinsurance. It's worked very well in getting group insurance growing at the fastest rate of all the segments, getting superannuation trustees to double cover, triple cover, and spend a lot more on the underinsurance. But it still remains and it still is a very big topic, and hopefully the growth will still continue. As I said, in terms of growth, the group life for a number of years has dominated growth compared to the retail lump sum market and the retail IP market. And it will be interesting to see how long that outperformance lasts. on the one hand, I think the one-off stepped increases in cover have probably slowed down. Also, funds starting to take up longer-term IP cover as opposed to shorter-term IP cover or even no IP cover at all. But counteracting that might be very high price rises in the group risk segment, which could, again, result in another set of step changes in the market. But if the prediction that more business will move to personal super compared to group super, and if the banks are quite successful in getting my super products off the ground, which personally I think they will, then we will see probably a faster growth rate in retail, in the retail segment. And I think with the massive amount of self-managed super funds that are out there and the growth and explosion that we've seen there, we could see a lot of, again, retail cover emerging from that segment, because a lot of self-managed super funds don't have life insurance, and there is pressure for them to take their life insurance needs a lot more seriously. This is stats which are unfortunately a bit dated from Plan for Life, and it just shows who the largest insurers are. AMP, which bought AXA, is up there. The NAB or MLC, which bought Aviva, is also up there. And I think TAL now, based on current stats, is now actually the second largest group. But the two largest groups as at that time have actually been the groups that have been struggling the most in terms of recent market share growth. So it might be that acquisitions aren't necessarily a good thing. But I wouldn't be the first to probably prove that point. In terms of growth, whilst it's still high, it's been a little bit below the long-term averages. The long-term average is in the red line, and the actual rate is the blue line. The direct market is fascinating, really interesting for those of you who are working in it or watching it. There's a lot of players. There's two particularly large players, which is Hanover, who've teamed up with Hollard, and they operate under a number of brands. And I understand they're selling over $70 million of direct business a year. And TAL, under the brand insurance line and a few other partnerships that they've got, I believe, are possibly selling the same or even more. We've also seen Suncorp growing quite a lot in the direct space. I think they managed to sell over $30 million in direct business through their house of brands insurance, general insurance businesses. So they're doing quite well there, and they say they've got a lot of upside potential. And there's a few other players like Swiss who I think team up also with Hollard, and they sell to Medibank customers. And a few other smaller players in that segment. But a lot of brands, a lot of TV advertising. My own research suggests that about 90% of the sales come through TV and about 10% come through telemarketing or other call centers or true direct through things like websites. Reinsurers, and I hope I don't get any of this wrong or offend any of the reinsurers in the room, but from what I've seen, there's four major reinsurers. Swiss, RGA, Munich, and Hanover. What I've seen, Swiss, RGA, and Hanover are the larger ones in the group markets. In retail, it's Munich and RGA that I see as dominant, and I'm thinking more about newer business rather than necessarily in-force portfolios. And in direct, Hanover and Swiss seem to be leading the charge in their participation in that segment. Just in the interest of time, I'm going to skip this slide. These are stats from APRA that show the interesting profitability that's emerging in the various segments. All the money's in lump sum, retail lump sum, that includes direct, and I think it includes consumer credit insurance, and little or no profits in group and in retail IP. So I think nothing new there, but the interesting thing is that the lowest profits are in the highest growing segments, which is not a good thing. And this is just another representation of this. This is an extract from an article that was in the AFR a few months ago, and that article in turn was referencing some very large price rises that are being seen in the group risk markets. This is an extract from a Credit Suisse publication. On the left-hand side, the chart there just showing the reported profit margins from some of the larger insurers, which includes AMP, MLC, CBA, the ones who offer public reporting of their results. And the lapse rates for those same insurers on the right-hand side and have been increasing. And again, I think a lot of the lapse rates are because quite a few of those insurers included in those graphs are uncompetitive rather than necessarily consumers ditching their cover for reasons such as unaffordability or the evil advisors churning, or so-called churning, of life insurance policies. In terms of profitability, unfortunately, this is too small for you to see, but on the left-hand side is an extract from a Munich Re report a few years ago where they took a massive hit, capitalized loss to their bottom line. I think it was $200 million or thereabouts. And again, on the right-hand side is reporting from ANZ, AMP, NAB, and CBA showing a lot of experience losses in prior years. The point on this slide is what I mentioned earlier, where we're seeing the runoff of a lot of the older investment products in life insurance portfolios and the older, very high margin life risk products, products that were sold at double the price that we're starting to see in the newer products in the industry, which again is one of the reasons why life insurance advisors might move customers because it's in their interest as opposed to churn. But again, it's a big challenge for I think, the manufacturers to explain to their shareholders or otherwise as to why their profits are not growing. This slide just shows how each channel targets their customers. You'll see group insurance sells a lot through industry funds and a lot through platforms. Organizations like the Commonwealth Bank sell a lot of insurance through the Colonial First Choice platform run by Colonial First State, and it's the same with other big companies like AMP, MLC, and so on. And a lot of that is also through employers. And in terms of retail insurance, you've got direct channels and you've got advisors. Advisors get a lot of their sales from referrals and their own marketing. And the direct channels sell a lot through TV and telemarketing, and a lot also through credit events where it's a lender that's selling a loan and often selling life insurance on an opt-out basis or disguised as a lump sum addition to the loan. And that's where a lot of the sales come from. This also shows where some of the products are mainly sold in the various channels. And again, I'll call out something like funeral cover, which is largely sold through TV advertising, where its target market seems to be watching and responding to the cover. And again, it's really only death cover that seems to be consistently sold across all the channels. I'll go quickly through the next few slides, and that is really extracts from AIHW, the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, and they've got some very interesting statistics on how the population is changing from a demographic point of view and also a lot of the health changes that are happening over time. So the Australian population is changing quite markedly in many respects. You can see single households are rising, percentage of people born overseas rising. The average age of people in Australia is up a lot. The average age of death has changed a lot, and that's going to change a lot of the requirements for the products that they'll be consuming. There should be a lot more demand for living products like income protection, less so than products like death cover, because people are living longer and the requirements are changing, such as single people. And then there's very interesting statistics on how the state of health is changing over time. The top left is life expectancy, which everyone knows is going up. Cardiovascular deaths on the right going down. Males now almost as low as females. 6% is the number of people or families who have a smoker in their house today versus 31% just in 1995. That's a massive change. 6 in 10 people who have a heart attack in 2009 survived, compared to less than half in 1997. So big changes happening there. And again, on this slide, there's some random charts which show some of the positive trends, such as survival after a heart attack going up. And on this chart, there's some unfortunately negative trends too, though, in different forms, such as a rise in obesity, the rise in mental illness incidents. And for whatever reason, I think on this chart, there's an increasing trend in end-stage kidney disease, which I think might be attributable to the rise in type 2 diabetes that we're starting to see. Next section is the psychology around buying insurance. And Firstly, some extracts from a survey that a group called Life Broker did, and that's followed by some research which Deloitte did in the USA. But it's very easy to find these surveys, and it just shows that consumers are very apathetic about life insurance and very naive about life insurance. They don't know how much it costs. They get it wrong. They think insurance is much more expensive than it is. They don't necessarily understand the difference between life insurance and income protection insurance. And they have all sorts of misconceptions about how life insurance works, how the payouts work, whether life insurers are honest or not, and so on and so forth. So I think the distributors of insurance, the government, the regulators, the manufacturers all still have a big job to do to increase the awareness and understanding of insurance. The survey here, for those of you who want to hop onto the Life Broker website, just has the results of some very interesting questions, and it's almost quite remarkable to see how naive consumers are in the space. And again, I'm just conscious of time. I'm skipping through this. This is a Deloitte survey where I think they showed that Americans almost think insurance is twice as expensive as it really is in practice. In terms of what I've seen and in terms of product development trends over, say, the last 10 years, for the products that are sold using advice, we've seen some price rises in income protection in recent months, and I think that's going to occur for at least the next 12 months to 18 months, just like we saw in 2001. Product linking has become a big trend where people are structuring their cover inside of super and some cover outside of super to maximize or optimize the tax and other consequences of having the cover. And again, that's one of the reasons, too, why there has been lapses in the industry, because people have moved their cover from just a non-superannuation structure to a hybrid structure. We've seen more use of electronic applications. We've seen more partial traumas in the trauma products. In terms of research houses' definitions and so on, lots of tweaking, but very much at the fringes. Nothing major has happened there in quite some time. Small changes in underwriting limits. More cover for traditionally higher-risk occupations. So we've seen some insurers move quite innovatively, I'd like to say, into sectors such as mining and farming areas, which have grown in terms of Australian employment, and some small changes or improvements in the technology offering. So you can see not as much as people might think on the product development space. And in terms of the direct channels, very little in product development. I've seen an innovative product from an organization called Freedom, which offers funeral cover where the first year is free. But other than that, there's not much happening in terms of innovation around product or pricing. The innovation is more so around trying new distribution channels like AIA, working with Priceline to try distribute products successfully or not through that channel. Now, superannuation, I'll touch on that. Matt, how are we going with time?
You've got about 15 minutes left.
Okay. Superannuation, I'll try fly through to give some time for questions. Main point, again, is linking it to life insurance, a massive source of money for life insurance premiums. About 0.5% of assets, as I mentioned earlier, are being used to pay life insurance premiums each year. But the segment is huge. The self-managed super fund segment is particularly large and growing particularly fast. It's the largest segment, I think over $400 billion in funds there to be able to use to pay for life insurance, as well as providing lots of money for retirement. And what the next few slides are doing is just showing how the industry's moved from the past, where insurers have relied largely on money in bank accounts or credit cards to fund life insurance premiums, and that's a $600 billion type funding pool. But now we're seeing SMSFs, $450 billion, industry super funds, also very large, retail super funds, very large, and adding all that up is $2 trillion of money available to fund insurance premiums. A lot of our customers we come across say, well, I've already got insurance in my superannuation fund, and they're not necessarily keen on getting advice in terms of their life insurance cover. But the work we've done have shown that there is a lot of value that can be added to people who've got cover, generic cover in group or industry fund or other type arrangements where the product design is very much one size fits all, and it has some unfortunate consequences for some members, such as cover falling as they get older. Whereas in our experience, people want more cover as they get older. That's when there is more awareness of the need for life insurance. People are seeing their friends and family, unfortunately, get ill at older ages, and they've also got more money to pay for insurance. So concepts like declining cover are good from an academic point of view and good for affordability, but I don't think necessarily what consumers do want. Another trend which I've noticed with great interest around the world is wellness programs being linked to insurance, life insurance and health insurance. And I know of one insurer that's launching with something later in the year, which is going to be quite interesting to see. But there already are a few insurers that have smaller wellness programs in the local market, and it's going to be interesting to see how those unfold over the years. And the wellness programs are not necessarily designed to encourage customers to claim less, whilst that is one of the goals, and there certainly has been achievement in those goals. A lot of it is around pooling buying power and getting those consumers deals at other organizations like airlines that that the insurers can get with bulk purchasing. And also much, much more improved retention rates because of these wellness programs, and loyalty is certainly part of that. So I'm hoping to see that emerge in the local market, both in life insurance and in health insurance. Just some stats here, which shows the mix in the various segments in the Australian retail super and non-superannuation segments. You can see superannuation dominates the non-superannuation investment segment, like managed funds, by a significant amount. And even within the retail segment, which has been the bastion of non-superannuation products in the past, the superannuation segment continues to dominate quite materially. And the chart on the left just shows how large the Australian superannuation industry is on a global scale. And as I mentioned earlier, it's the fourth largest market, which is quite an achievement for such a small population. Again, I'm just conscious of time, so I am unfortunately going to have to skim through a number of slides. One thing I'll say about the self-managed super fund segment, which I find is interesting, and that is, whilst there's lots of talk about the self-managed super fund segment and how big it is and how explosive the growth has been in that segment, what I think may happen is that with the change in the last year or so, where there's been a big clampdown from government on contribution caps, we may not see that segment grow as fast as we have in the past. We saw a lot of money flowing in 2007 and a few years after, but since then, I think the net flows have tapered down quite a lot because it's hard to get a lot of money into a self-managed super fund now. And a self-managed super fund really does require a fair amount of money to be viable from a cost point of view. And we're also seeing the retail funds and even some of the industry funds offering a lot more investment choice, which makes the need to have a self-managed super fund far less, unless you're investing in direct property, you're gearing for direct property, or you're owning your own business premises. There's no real need, in my opinion, to have a self-managed super fund. On the post-retirement side, and in terms of aged care, there's a few interesting stats where which I'd like to just call out. The one stat which is in the what colour is that, maroon font or pink font, and that there's a myth that a lot of people are in residential homes more so than there really is in reality, but there's an inordinate amount of care taking place in the home, and that care is provided both by family and other loved ones, and a lot of government packages that provides care at home. And we're seeing many more changes from the government. These are the numbers of government services that are provided under various program titles, and there's a number of acronyms there which I won't go into, but there's three times as much services being provided at home than there is in residential care, and the government's directing far more amounts of money to stay-at-home care as opposed to residential care. This chart, which is from a government study, shows the length of time that people stay in residential care. And again, sorry, you probably can't see some of the font, but you'll see that most people really only stay in residential care for about 18 months. Very few people stay as long as 6 or 7 years. And it's that year and a half that people are in residential care that they use acute care and care that costs a lot of money. So we might see the emergence of some long-term care products that for a smaller amount of money paid up front, a larger amount is paid in those later stages of life, in, say, the last year, year and a half, where a bigger lump sum is able to be provided to supplement any money that people might still have in their home or in their superannuation funds to pay for that care. There's also a lot of changes in the various government incentives or costs that apply in residential care, and that is going to cause a raft of changes in the aged care sector in the years ahead. So I'm just going to skip to the last slide and just cover the takeaways again and then go through to hopefully about 10 minutes of questions. But 3 points in the life risk market. We have a vibrant and growing life insurance industry with three primary distribution channels being retail advice, direct and group. Competition is strong and there are profit pressures. Reinsurers play a very important role in the industry, but there are far fewer active reinsurers than direct insurers, so that I think does limit what the frontline insurers can do in terms of some of their pricing and other strategies. And in superannuation, the super and life segments retain a very strong linkage, with superannuation being the dominant funder of life insurance premiums. The superannuation sector is growing strong and will continue to grow with mandatory super contributions and with that rising slowly from 9% to 12%. Self-managed super funds seem to be dominating the story for the time being, but the contribution caps that I've mentioned might curtail some of that growth. And the post-retirement sector is certainly one for everyone to watch and see how that changes quite dramatically and how it explodes over time. So thank you for that, and apologies for rushing through so many of the slides and skipping some of the slides, and I hope I don't get penalised for that, Matt. But happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thanks, Clive. Sorry, could just there's a microphone up there if you don't mind being recorded.
Yeah, I was just curious, is how does the insurance industry relate differently to the self-managed super funds as opposed to the industry super funds and the retail funds?
With life insurance? I think, so the question was, how does life insurance differ within self-managed super fund and, say, industry super funds or platforms? With self-managed super funds, so the short answer is there's no real difference from a legislative point of view in what products can be housed in a self-managed super fund versus corporate super funds or industry super funds. What you see in self-managed super funds are the funds are often set up by accountants, and possibly for that reason, there's far more focus just on the investments of that self-managed super fund and less focus on the life insurance side, which might explain why so little life insurance is associated with self-managed super. With industry super funds and platforms, there's a lot of group or compulsory insurance, so you see a far greater uptake or prevalence of the life insurance in those segments, which is why life insurance through those segments is far larger than, say, self-managed super funds. But there have been some changes, some requirements for self-managed super funds to have a life insurance strategy, and who knows, that might change the uptake.
Thanks. Any more questions for Clive?
Joanne Morgan. With recent announcements regarding tax on deferred annuities...
I'm sure I'll pull it down.
Sorry. Recent announcements with regarding future tax on or tax breaks on deferred annuities and how that might interplay with the superannuation space and what are life insurance companies doing around that?
Yeah, so the question there was deferred lifetime annuities, recent announcements in the budget and elsewhere, and what might happen with product development in that space. I hope we will see some product development trends. And products that might look like when you retire, you only start using, say, 90% of your balance on retirement, 10% invested in a deferred lifetime annuity, and that provides a boost, say, in 10 years' time, if you're still alive at that time. The short answer is going to be it depends what the owners of distribution do. If the owners of distribution want to push those products and sell those products, they will sell. If the owners of distribution don't want to do that because they don't have a life insurance license or otherwise, it won't be sold. A lot of what gets sold is influenced by who owns and controls distribution.
Any other questions?
Can you just comment on life cycle insurance and whether it's going to be a popular trend in future?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So life cycle insurance. So my understanding, just to make sure I calibrate it right, is life cycle insurance is where you might find, say, in a group scheme, the trustees try design insurance so it meets the needs of people. So you might have more cover at younger ages when people supposedly have mortgages and young kids and the need for insurance is higher, and that might decrease over time with people's age where there's arguably less of a need because their house might be paid off and so on. I find it fascinating because what we see when we speak to the public and consumers is it's totally the opposite. People who are young don't want life insurance, but I do admit that they do need it, and they often can't afford life insurance. And to that extent, this what the superannuation funds do is good because they use some of the money that's stuck in super to provide them with the cover they need. But what I've certainly seen is that is probably not right, and that is the need and the desire, the utility for insurance is very high at older ages, and that's where people don't want to give up cover, and they don't want their cover to reduce. They don't want their cover to end when they turn 65. So life cycle insurance, I think, is flawed in that space because it's not meeting the needs of what consumers want. And at those ages, let's say they're in a group scheme, they're not healthy enough to get cover on their own often. And even if they are healthy, they haven't adopted strategies like taking out level premium. So the cover at that age is just too expensive for them to get. It would have been much better when they were in, say, their 40s or 30s to enter into a level premium structure so that when they do hit 65 or age 65, they can actually continue that cover through to, say, age 75 or 80, which is where they really want the cover to be in force.
Hi, Clive. You hear me?
Yeah.
The paradigm that life insurance is sold, not bought, do you think that's as robust as ever, and do you see it changing within our lifetimes?
Sure. It's Leon, thanks for that question. It's incredibly hard to sell life insurance to somebody, incredibly hard. I challenge anyone in this room who's never done it to try it. I think it's easier to sell ice to Eskimos, or harder to sell ice to Eskimos, or whatever the saying is. I probably got that wrong. People are selfish, is one reason why they don't buy life insurance. There's a lot of cultural impacts on people buying life insurance. Certain cultures just not keen on life insurance. People don't want to spend the money. They tighten their budgets. People think it will never happen to them. People don't want to go through the underwriting process. They don't want to answer questions about their health. But everyone needs insurance. Even very wealthy people need insurance because a lot of their money is often tied up in illiquid investments, and they need money to fund for expenses for their family if they were to pass away. So I don't see it changing, Leon, and that's why I'd love to see more incentives from the government, more concessions about dropping stupid taxes like stamp duty, because the industry needs it and really does provide an incredibly important social good in life insurance. I've never seen a life insurance claim or trauma claim or other claim that isn't tragic and one where the family didn't absolutely need that money. Every single life insurance story, from at least a financial point of view of the work we do as an industry, is a good news story. And there's just unfortunately not enough of those stories that are told because of the high levels of underinsurance.
Great, thank you. Well, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for the questions. Don't forget, there are feedback forms if you'd like to fill those in. Thanks very much, Clive, for preparing such an interesting presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.